So the title of my talk is Opportunities to Practice as Laypersons. And a lot of it is opportunities to practice in the center, various opportunities. Dharma practice at the time of the Buddha was mainly reserved for monks and nuns, or bhikkhus, as they were called, or recluses, people who wandered through the forest. There is some stories about lay people doing practice, but it's really rare. A monk or a bhikkhu has a very, very restricted life and is very conducive for practicing. They abide by the rules of what's called the Vinaya, or the rules of order for the monks and nuns, and it's around 230 rules, which really puts their lives in a very narrow setting. For those who don't know, in the Theravadan tradition, monks and nuns are not allowed to possess any money. They have only like six or seven possessions: their robes, their alms bowl, a razor to shave their heads, sandals for their shoes. And they live in a hut. They have a mat to sleep on, and it's very, very restricted. They only eat one to two meals a day. They don't eat afternoon. A lot of the times is spent in silence. There's also a lot of interesting rules. A male monk is not allowed to be in the same room alone with a female, or a female nun is not allowed to be in the same room alone with a male. So it's really restricted. Another restriction of practice they practice is called guarding the senses. And so they're constantly mindful of what comes into their senses and not stimulating. They also are not supposed to watch TV or shows. These are things that stimulate the mind and bring it away from the present moment. Lay practice consisted mainly of practices of practicing the five precepts, not to kill, not to steal. The way they talked about it in those days was not to commit adultery, but today it's not to misuse your sexuality, not to lie, and not to use intoxicants. And the other big practice was generosity. And a lot of the generosity was around taking care of the monks and nuns, providing them with food. The Buddha did give a lot of guidance on interpersonal relationships, and he gave guidance of how one should relate to one's parents and how one should relate to one's spouse and your children and your servants. One of the big advices he gave lay people was not to get into debt, because that can really burden people. But a lot of lay people were interested in gaining merit through generosity and doing this minimal form of practice so they can gain better rebirths than they had now, either coming back and leading a more richer life or going to one of the heaven realms. And for a lot of Asians, this is still true today. They support the monastics, and most people practice dana, or generosity, and daily precepts. In the last 100 years, there's been some change, especially within Burma. In Burma, there's many lay people who do meditate, and they have various meditation centers. A lot of people go on. That's where they spend their vacations, at meditation centers. And there's actually a line of actually lay meditation masters. The most famous is Uba Khin, who was a meditation master, and he actually worked for the government of Burma. Most people know Uba Khin through his two main disciples. One of them is Goenka, who's an Indian businessman who's brought mainly Uba Khin's teachings and ways of practicing, his way of apostasy, which is different than we do here, to the world. His other famous disciple is Ruth Dennison, who's an American who went in the late 50s or early 60s to Burma to study with him and then came here. Another famous lay meditation master's Munindra, that was Joseph Goldstein's teacher, who studied under Mahasi Sayadaw. Mahasi Sayadaw was responsible for mainly the type of meditation we do here, the careful noting, which, as I said, he started a lot of meditation centers in Burma where many lay people would practice. And also Deepa Ma, who was an Indian woman, another famous lay practitioner. And supporting the monastics and the whole Buddhist practice is really part of that culture. And in our culture, it would be really strange to see monks going out along Hopkins Avenue for their alms rounds. Now, the history of the Dharma practice in the West is mainly started by Westerners going to Asia in the 50s and in the 60s and in the 70s. Three main people that everybody's familiar with is Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, and Sharon Salzberg went to India and to Burma and to Thailand and studied in the various masters. Jack Kornfield became a monk. And when they came back, they wanted to bring back the practice without a lot of the cultural trappings. And the big thing was sitting intensive retreats. And so they started the practice of sitting intensive retreats. And so people used to go to retreats. And then there were some people who were like nomads who would travel around from city to city where there'd be retreats going on. And after a while, sitting groups form naturally. People go to retreats and they want to do something with their practice afterwards. And so sitting groups would start. And actually the center is really an outgrowth of a sitting group. The people who sat up at Spirit Rock, well, that time there wasn't a Spirit Rock, they were a nomadic center also. And so a sitting group was formed in this area by the Noodlemans, who I think one of them is not alive anymore. And so they formed a sitting group. And then for a while, there was a group of 12, and then Howie Cohn, who was a teacher of Spirit Rock, led it for a while, and then Gil Fronsdale was going for his doctorate at Stanford, so he was in this area, and plus he was being trained as a teacher by Jack Kornfield, so he needed to do student teaching, and so he was invited to come to this center, and that was around 1990. And it was a very small group, and they met at several places, eventually at the Friends, and then eventually this place was bought. So it really started to grow. And so a lot of what we do here today is not traditional, what you'd see in Asia, a lot of the programs, a lot of way of the practice. A lot of Western meditation centers is a real gearing towards psychotherapy. And I think one teacher at a retreat summarized is basically a lot of what we're doing here is an experiment. There's a lot of things teachers are trying, and some things will end up working and some things will not working. There is, as I said before, when the teachers came here, they really tried to find the essence of the practice and the meditation, and so a lot of the other practices were not brought over, and teachers are wrestling now with whether they threw the baby out with the bathwater. And so it says that these original groups started with people sitting retreats. Most people who join, like this center today, or other sitting groups, don't start that way. Although in the center there's a large group that do sit long residential retreats. Most people who come to this center haven't sat a retreat or don't sit a lot. So what are the opportunities to practice as a lay person? And when one looks at this question, or one wants to set up a practice, a meditation practice or a whole spiritual practice, there's two things a person should become clear on. What are your intentions and what are you looking for to do? My first teacher and the first Buddhist center I studied at was the Zen Center of Los Angeles. And the first teacher I studied under was Joko Beck, who many of you may know. She wrote Everyday Zen. And she's at the Zen Center San Diego. But that time she was at the Zen Center of Los Angeles. And the way they introduced people to the center is they had a day and a half workshop over 2 weeks on the center. And so the first day you got to interview with a teacher, and I interviewed with her. And after talking about what I did, she asked a bunch of questions, what I did for a living. And she said, well, what do you want out of this practice? And asked me, what do I really want? So she could gear her teachings to what I want. So that's a question people need to ask themselves is, what are they looking for when they come here or when they have a practice, when they meditate? Are you looking to get calmer? Are you looking to get a better understanding of yourself? Are you looking to pursue a spiritual life? Are you looking for liberation? Buddhism talks about liberation as the ultimate goal. Or are you really just want to just come here to listen to talks and hang out with people? And none of these is a right answer. Just you really need to determine, what you want to get out of it. I know years ago I took Tai Chi. I just wanted to learn Tai Chi and get more in touch with my body. And after I took the course several times, to go to the intermediate level required a lot more of my time, and I really didn't want to learn Tai Chi in that depth, so I was not interested in pursuing that. So, like I said, with these various things, there's no one correct answer. For each individual, there's a correct answer. Another thing to look at, is something about yourself. If you're very uncomfortable being with people, really uncomfortable being with people, but you really feel comfortable meditating, maybe meditation really isn't what you should be doing. Maybe you should be going out and learning how to interact with people. So it's important to be honest with yourself. And depending on what you're looking for will determine how you use the opportunities here. The other thing is you need to set realistic goals. If you join the center the first day and you decide you want to live like a monk and live a really restricted life and you've never sat before, you may be biting off more than you can chew and you may burn out quickly. On the other hand, if you decide, well, I'm going to come here and I'm going to be mindful for 3 minutes a day. And if you practice like that every day, you may not see any changes. So you don't want to go to extremes. So in the opportunities to practice here, I'm going to start from the simple to the hard. And what I consider the simple is setting up a daily sitting practice. And setting up a daily sitting practice is like setting up an exercise program. Some people, when they decide to exercise, they do it on the weekends and they go running for 2 hours or something, or work out with weights for 3 hours and then do anything the rest of the week. Usually the reason they don't do anything the rest of the week is they're so sore from running for 2 to 3 hours on the weekends. And what's advised by sports physicians and sports coaches is that you do a little something every day. But the important thing is to do it every day. So instead of running for 2 hours, if you run for maybe 20 minutes every day, you'll see a lot of benefit over the long run. And the same thing is true with a sitting practice. It's important to do it every day for a certain amount of time. The amount of time, what I recommend for people, is figure out how long you feel comfortable sitting and sit a little longer. So if you feel comfortable for 10 minutes and then you're going to start to feel uncomfortable, sit 12 or 15 minutes a day. But the important thing is to do it every day, not just when you feel like doing it. And over time, it's a very subtle practice, but over time you will see changes in yourself. Misha Merrill, who's a Zen teacher she'll be speaking here this Sunday. She says, like, when she doesn't sit, she feels really out of sorts. And then when she goes to do her day, she'll get really caught up in things real easy. My wife and I look at it like when we don't sit every day, it's like not taking a shower or brushing your teeth. So one can set up a sitting program every day for themselves. And then the next level, I would say, is sitting retreats. In retreats, you really get time to really get into the practice of mindfulness over a long time. And there's two types of retreats. There's non-residential and residential. I'll talk about the non-residential lasts one day. They have them here once a month. And it says it's a chance to develop your practice. And it's also close to your life, so you can take what you learn in the practice very easily into your life. And at this center, there's two types of residential retreats. There's called residential retreats with instructions and residential retreats without instructions. And the one with instructions is there's guided meditations every period. The ones without instructions, it's like taking a chunk out of a residential retreat, and there's silence, and there's no instructions, and you just sit and walk, eat lunch, sit and walk, sit and walk. And Gil gives, or the teacher here, gives a talk in the afternoon. Now, the next is residential retreats, and those are very different from non-residential retreats and very, very different from having a daily sitting practice. And those retreats last anywhere from 2 days to, but Spirit Rock can go 2 months, or you can go 3 months out at Barre, Massachusetts. And it's a chance to get really intimate with your practice. The form of the retreat is basically sitting and walking. You do around 8 or 9 hours of that a day. But besides being mindful when you're sitting, you're encouraged to be mindful when you're not sitting or doing formal walking meditation, when you're going to walk to a area, when you're in your room, and when you eat. There's meditation practices for eating mindfully. And so in everything you do, and over the days, the mind and the body really settle in, and some very deep states of peace and equanimity can settle in. And also some difficult things about yourself will come up. And it can be quite intensive. One thing that is universally true, it's been found out, is the first 2 to 3 days are the hardest. And then after that, it gets a lot easier and a lot pleasant. The first couple of days, you're tired, you're in a new environment, you are unwinding. Although a lot of people really do enjoy three-day retreats, but if you ever sit a retreat, I'd encourage people to sit more than 3 days, and they can see that change. It's also said, and I found this to be true also, after 7 days, there's another change, and after 10 days, there's also another change. Now, one of the biggest benefits of a retreat, and even if you didn't sit, if you just did this for the whole time around a retreat, you'd feel quite different, is they are silent. So there's almost no talking, except for seeing a teacher, which is like every other day, and maybe minimal talk, sometimes there's jobs to do. And so that was once asked at a retreat, about the benefits of the silence. And that teacher felt like if you had like a 7-day retreat and all you did was you did regular tasks and everything, you didn't even sit, just were silent and didn't communicate with people, it would be a very profound experience. So at the end of the retreat, many people, and most people, have a really good retreat and they feel really wonderful, really at peace. And then the big question comes in, well, how do we take this into the world? And some of the things I'm talking about in this talk, and one of the big things also they encourage is the daily sitting practice. And so the next step is, how do you bring your practice into your life, as opposed to your life into your practice? If you want to practice all the time in your life, that may be biting off too much to chew. So it's good to take it in small chunks. Another thing, I've been assuming that everybody has the time to sit every day. Some people actually don't. Kamala Masters, who's a famous meditation teacher, she actually was too busy. She has like five children. And Manindra, who was her teacher, suggested, well, like when you're washing the dishes, just be real mindful that you're washing the dishes. And when you walk from one point of the house to another, there's another woman who said, in her house, because she had a family to take care of, when she came to this one hallway, she would always be mindful. And that's a way to bring practice into our life when we're not on the cushion, is we can set certain times when you're walking from certain areas or when you're driving in your car to work, that those times will be mindful. It's my opinion, without a daily sitting practice, it's very difficult to do. Another good practice to do in one's life is practicing right speech. And that's a very, very difficult practice to do. Part of the practice is not to gossip, but you can break it down in small chunks. I know when I started the practice, like, I think it was like 14 years ago, there was a friend of mine, him and I just did this, when we got together, we would not gossip. And then it spread out with other people. So we start off small. And there's actually two very good books on practicing in life. One is called Work as Spiritual Practice by Lewis Richmond. Lewis was a Zen priest at the Zen Center of San Francisco. He's a lay person now in business. Another one is Zen and Work by Les Kay. Les Kay gives actually courses at businesses about how to be mindful and having good practices at work. Les is a very interesting example of a lay person. Les is a certified, was a Zen priest, but he's also a, he's received Dharma transmission through the Zen Center of San Francisco, which means he's certified to be a Zen teacher. And he's been the abbot of Canon Do for the last 20 years. Actually, for those of you who know the book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, those were talks given by Suzuki Roshi, and it was in Les's garage that those talks were recorded. But Les always lived out in the world. He actually, for most of his Zen practice, he worked at IBM. He was an engineer. He talks about that in the book. He's, I believe, 70 now.
Which book did he write?
He wrote Zen and Work, it's called, by Les Kay.
What's his last name?
K-A-Y-E. We may have a copy of it in the library. As he's retired now, but he's a lay person. Misha Merrill, who I talked about, who's a Dharma heir of his, she's a school teacher. So there are a number of people who are, if you think you, quote, can't make it as a lay person, that's two examples. I also have a friend, Lee Brazington, who's a computer software engineer, and he's a meditation teacher. He studied under Ayakema. So, it can be done. The next level of difficulty of practice, I would say, is working with friends and significant others. We always run into problems here and there at times. And to be mindful and to be kind and to open up to that, sometimes we can really get caught up either in our anger or judgment or other things with our friends and with our significant others. Dana, as a way of practicing, Dana means generosity. When people think of Dana, they immediately think of giving money, if holding on is a real thing for you, the practice of generosity in terms of money is a good practice. And that's a whole other topic, which I gave a talk on a while ago. But when I think of dana practice, I'm thinking of more basic things, like you just feel really irritable and crummy, and instead of taking it out on a coworker or your spouse or something, giving them a smile. And that really is an act of generosity. You're not going to let go of your anger on somebody, and your spouses and coworkers will definitely appreciate that. I would say one of the most difficult areas, I'm not familiar with this at all, in practice is parenting. And I know some of you that I know here are parents, and I hear about your trials and tribulations with your children. And I know Gil now is a parent, and it's a whole new practice for him. He definitely says, you know, I told you that, you know, I think daily sitting is easy and going to retreats is easy. He says being in the monastery, and he's practiced in Burma and Japan, is much, much, much easier than being a parent. Especially when you have a 10-month-old and a 5-year-old. If you met his 5-year-old, you'd know being in the monastery is definitely easier. Another thing is volunteering and engaged Buddhism. There's a movement in our community of circles called Engaged Buddhism. A lot of this is involved with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. But it's not just going to demonstrations or going to prisons or sitting vigils at San Quentin when they're going to go to execute somebody, but it's being mindful and just being bearing witness to what's going on, and not with a sense of equanimity. And to do that takes a real lot. And the leaders in this movement that I've met, I've been very, very impressed with their practice. Other opportunities to practice, there used to be what was called in this group Kalamita sitting groups or study groups. Years ago, we used to go over a fellow Sangha member's house, and we used to sit for around a half hour, and then we actually used to read one of the sutras. We'd go around reading it, and we'd talk about it. Another one is Dharma Friends. A Dharma Friends puts on a lot of social events, but they like to have a theme or to be mindful when you're doing things. They had Buddhist bowling, which they don't do anymore, but we had a discussion about that and why it actually is a very good practice. I mean, there's a lot of sitting, and you get up and you walk. There's a lot of sitting. That's one person. I felt it was really a good practice for us. It created a lot of humility. I mean, a lot of us hadn't bowled in a long time. The way we did bowl, it definitely gave us humility. Another very good practice is yoga, and the center puts on a lot of yoga events. And there are people just come here for the yoga, but to really get in touch with your body and mindfully feel the stretches. And the last thing I'd like to say is a life goes on whether we practice or not. Life's uncertainties will come to our lives. Sickness, old age, and death will come to ourselves and loved ones. And as a teacher said a couple of weeks ago, was here, who spends most of her life in Cambodia working with people who have AIDS, says if you wait till your deathbed to practice, it's too late. And what she meant by this, next time you become sick or really don't feel well, try to be mindful. And it is very, very difficult, if almost impossible. And when you're dying, if you're not very well grounded in your practice, it'll also be almost impossible to practice. So I encourage everybody, whichever way you feel, to practice. So that's my talk, and thank you all for listening. And any questions, discussions, comments, I welcome them. Yes?
Why did you change your various disciplines when you first... You said you started exam.
You know, a lot of that, for a lot of people, is like people go to a certain... They live in a certain community, and they're a certain type of Christian, let's say. And they don't have exactly that Christian denomination in the center, in their neighborhood, so they check out something else. And it wasn't this type of... I knew about this type of Vipassana group. It was other ones, but I knew about this one, but there wasn't any in Los Angeles. And so I just... checked out the Zen Center of Los Angeles. And actually, Joko Beck's interesting. Gil talks, describes her as a closet Vipassana teacher, because a lot of her teachings really is like Vipassana. The main practice at the Zen Center of Los Angeles at that time was koan practice. And so after she left, I started doing that, and I didn't particularly care for that. And then so I went over to Shinzen Young's group. But actually, the Zen and Vipassana, or Theravadin practice, is closely related, and people are constantly changing and doing both. Gil is certified in both traditions. He started out in Zen and did Vipassana, and there's people who go the other way, too. So it's very, very common to do both. And yet, not with Goenka, no. Shinzen Young, who I sat with, he was a student of Goenka, but I didn't do that practice. The main practice is a sweeping practice. Instead of being mindful in one area, it's actually sweeping through the body. Also, their retreats, I hear, are very intense, but they're free. The students support the retreats, and they have the basic 10-day retreat. And I hear the very... In this school of insight meditation, things are in some ways loose. I mean, people move and stuff like that, but there you're really... encouraged just to sit there. And if you want to see an excellent film, it's called Doing Time, Doing Vipassana. And it takes place in an Indian prison. It's a documentary on Goenka went in there and taught 10-day Vipassana retreats, and the change in people was really, really amazing. There's actually an article in one of the newspapers around here in San Francisco. They started doing that. But there are a number of Vipassana schools and techniques. And there's also a number of Theravadin schools. There's some that more emphasize concentration. I talked about my friend Lee. What he teaches, he more emphasizes concentration at first. Because, you know, there's the Eightfold Path, and two of them is right mindfulness and right concentration. So he's more developing the concentration. And actually, Gil is starting to do that more. The last one day was a whole one day devoted to concentration. Any other questions or comments?
Is Gil always here on every Monday?
No. Most Mondays. I was present here last Monday because he's teaching a 2-week residential retreat, which that retreat is actually sponsored by our center. I would say he's here 2/3 to 3/4 of the year. He takes a vacation in the summer, but he also teaches 1 to 2 week retreats. And I see in the schedule in February he's going to teach 1 month at Spirit Rock. Sometimes we have guest teachers will be here for like a month. And that's been really nice. He will be giving a talk here, I think it's the end of October, last week in October, which is either Halloween or the day before Halloween, is give a talk on Halloween, on the topic of Halloween. Gil Fronsdale, who's the resident teacher here. Any other questions, comments? So the next thing we're going to do is loving kindness. I'll lead you in a loving kindness meditation. That'll be it for the evening. So the important thing in doing loving kindness is everybody to be comfortable, not be too strained. And if there's any areas of tension in your body, if you can let that go, that's good. And concentrate on your heart center, around your heart. Just relax. And it's traditional to start doing loving kindness meditation first on yourself. And for some people, that's difficult. The Buddha said you can search all the world and you won't find one more deserving of love than yourself. In the morning, when I start doing loving-kindness meditation before I do my insight or concentration practice, if I have difficulty doing loving-kindness in myself, I think of somebody I really love and somebody I really want just to be happy, and I think of that feeling, and then I generate it towards myself, and then immediately I get a smile. And the traditional phrases, which I'll do. May I be happy. May my mind and body be at ease. May I be safe and secure. May I be healthy and strong. May I be at peace. And you can repeat these phrases or any other phrases you feel appropriate. As you'd want loving kindness for yourself, may everybody in this room wish happiness for everybody in this room. May everybody in this room be happy. May everybody in this room be at ease. May everybody in this room be peaceful. Radiating out this happiness to everybody in this neighborhood. May they all be happy. May they be at ease with their lives. Radiating out to all of Redwood City. May they all be happy and at ease. May all those in the Bay Area be happy and at ease. May all those people in North America be happy. May all those on the planet Earth be happy. May all the animals be happy. All the beings seen and unseen in all directions throughout all space and time. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings be peaceful. Thank you for coming.